MacCast, Wednesday, December 22nd, 2010. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the MacCast. I said, how you doing already, didn't I? Don't want to be repeating myself. Oh, it's going to be a crazy show, I can tell already. I've already had some audio issues. Was tweaking around things earlier. Never do that, by the way. If you have an audio set up and you get it set up, I kind of left things in place for 6 years now. I've been doing this for 6 years and never really tweaked with it. I was doing some things today and I muted my monitor. So I started the show. I couldn't even hear myself, but I digress. How's your holiday going? It's been wet here in Southern California. We've been raining for like 6 days. So things are all flooded and soggy, but otherwise I'm having a good time. I'm gearing up, getting ready for Christmas. I think got everything done so I can stay in the house. That's been nice through the rainstorm, just to be able to not have to go anywhere. Just sitting here working and getting ready for holiday time. You're probably getting ready too, and part of that getting ready might be catching up on your podcast, listening to some Mac Geek talk, and we're going to dive into that in just a minute. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and recognize one of our sponsors, Cocotec, makers of Pathfinder 5. It's a alternative to the Mac OS X built-in Finder. Actually, it's better than an alternative. That's kind of underselling it, if I was really being honest. But now is a perfect time to check out and pick up a copy of Pathfinder 5, because it's the end of the year. If you're like me, you like to kind of get things cleaned off, start doing your archiving, managing your files. So you're going to be dealing with files and folders and stuff like that. And Pathfinder is a great tool for managing all that. Features like the split pane browser. So you have a one window interface. You can split that interface and you can be browsing through different areas of your system and have that stuff side by side. So this is great when if you need to compare two folders and you want to see, do I have the same files here and there? What's going on? So that single window interface is really nice for doing that. Also, when you need to gather up a bunch of items to perform an action on them and they're in all different places of your system, they've got the drop stack, which is this handy little kind of shelf drawer that's up in the upper left-hand corner. And what you can do is you can grab files from different places, files, folders, what have you, throw them up there, and then once they're in there, you can move them to another location, or even better yet, they give you the ability gives you the ability to compress those, put them into a zip file, and they use the Stuffit engine for doing their compression. So works really well. Actually, that's come in handy, just as an aside, that's come in handy for me because sometimes I'll get files that I can't uncompress in the Finder, and they always uncompress in Pathfinder 5. I think it's due to that great Stuffit engine. But the other thing with the drop stack is you can burn right from there. So if you need to gather a bunch of files from a bunch of different locations to do an archive, throw them into the stack as you're browsing through and grabbing stuff. And then once you're done sort of gathering it all together, and it doesn't move the stuff, it just kind of puts pointers to it, then you can burn it off. And then you can go ahead and again from that stack, you can clean those files off your drive. If you're looking for those large files on your system, we've talked about some tools for doing that in the past. It's built into Pathfinder 5. They have a size browser, so you can just look at a folder, look at a volume, have it sort by the largest files in there and figure out what's taking up all your space, maybe archive that to a disk or throw it up into the cloud, get it off your system and sort of do that cleaning that you like to do at the end of the year. So great tool for all of that and a whole lot more. They have free trials available on their website. You can find it at cocotec.com. Pathfinder 5, check it out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So what do you say? Let's check out what Apple has been up to, what's been going on in the news. Starting off today, Apple just released a new tool for developers for creating iAds. It's called iAd Producer, And it makes it really easy to put together those cool ads that we see in the iOS and the different applications. And what I like about iAds is that, one, they're just really cool if you've ever played around with one. But the other thing is that it allows developers to get an additional revenue stream, which means we get good apps that are free or maybe potentially lower cost because of the iAd program. Apple kind of rolled it out. It was to select people. I don't know if with the addition of this tool, this means that they're going to be opening it up. I know they had opened it up to sort of app developers, so we've seen a few application kind of ads in there. I don't know if that was limited in scope or not, but now they've got this really cool tool that makes it easy for developers to put together really cool looking iAds. It has a visual development environment that automatically manages the HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript that goes into making an iAd. It even has a built-in JavaScript editing and debugging function. Comes with kind of all these cool templates that are already set up for different components and built-in animations and effects, so you can do all of that and not have to do any of the coding. It's a totally visual tool, but then you can also kind of get under the hood and mess with the JavaScript code and really fine tune and tweak things. It looks really neat. I'm in the iOS developer program, so I'm probably going to download it. I haven't had a chance to actually dive into it yet, but this validation, debugging, and it's completely free to members of the iOS developer program. So if you're in that program, you can head to developer.apple.com to check it out. You can also, I'll have a link to it in the show notes. They just have general information about it with some screenshots and stuff like that if you want to get a look at it, if you're just curious, over at Apple, at developer.apple.com/iAdProducer. So that's iAd Producer, and hopefully that means we're going to be seeing Apple doing some more stuff with iAds. There'd been some complaints that Apple was maintaining a lot of really tight control over the iAd program in terms of not only just the design of the iAds, but also the creative, and they had kind of butted heads with some of the advertising agencies and companies. It was turning people off. But I think when Apple launched iAds, they really wanted to make sure that they could really showcase what the platform could do. And they wanted sort of those elite ads that would be the thing to inspire, I think, other developers. And that gave them time, I think, to build this tool, this iAd Producer, then to allow other developers and people to open up and start producing iAds. Again, they didn't really come out and say what the approval process for iAds, or even, I don't think there was any information on how you would submit your iAds. I'm assuming you need to have some sort of contract or agreement with Apple. And I think you can sign up on their website to actually be contacted if you want to actually run an ad. So maybe this is just for developers to promote their own apps. I know Apple has already been doing that, but I would imagine at some point the tools will be opened up also to creative houses, ad agencies, and stuff like that. So I have a feeling in 2011, we're going to see Apple really open up the iAd program and start expanding it now that they've kind of had success with the initial rollout in the, and the companies that they partnered up with to do that. NPD Group took a look at the online music business and determined that iTunes is still on top. iTunes currently accounts for about 66.2% of all online music purchases. That is up from about 63.2% last year. To put that in contrast, Amazon came in second place with 13.3% share of the market. They were also up about 3% from 11% earlier in the year. So both companies gaining share in the digital music space, but iTunes clearly with a very wide lead over its nearest competitor. Something that the rumor sites will do from time to time is take a look at Apple's job listings that they post on their website to try and get an idea for the kinds of things that they might be working on for future products. And Apple Insider did that this week. When they did, they noticed that Apple had four new job listings that may point to them trying to expand their cartographic resources. The ads were specifically listed for engineers with deep knowledge of computational geometry or graph theory and experience in developing navigation software, listed as valuable assets or valuable knowledge for the applicants to have. Because of these listings, many of the sites believe that Apple is looking to roll its own mapping technology in iOS rather than rely on the maps from Google, which they've been using to date. Apple also made some other investments in mapping technology. If you remember, they acquired a company called Poly9, which is an online mapping company based in Quebec, and also acquired a company called PlaySpace that had a technology, a mapping technology called Pushpin. So building up all this engineering prowess could mean that Apple is planning something big, or it could just mean that they need some engineering talent to work on current projects. There's a lot of stuff in the iOS currently, even with using Google mapping technology, that they could need this type of engineer to leverage. So I'm not certain that I'm in line with a lot of the rumor websites. I think it's interesting to think about Apple rolling its own mapping technology, but I think Apple really prefers, if it can, to use stuff that's already out there and best of breed. And I really think Google has some of the best mapping technology on the planet. Now, we've been seeing some things on Android that Apple doesn't have and doesn't seem to get access to, stuff like built-in turn-by-turn directions, also some of the new 3D stuff that we're seeing on Android. So when you zoom down to the street level, they now have the ability to kind of pull up perspective-based 3D cities and buildings and stuff like that you can fly through. I don't know if that's stuff that they're holding back from Apple, and maybe Apple is building up a team to kind of give leverage to negotiations, but at the very least, they're going to have some great in-house engineering talent, so they certainly would have the capability to do that sort of thing or completely roll their own maps. And I think we've seen Apple do this in the past, where they build up technology. They might even completely develop a whole mapping system for iOS in the background, so that the day that things fall apart with Google or they don't get the kind of agreements or arrangements that they want, they can just say, well, you know what, we've got this ready to go. Let's just flip a switch, finish it up, and roll it into the next version of the operating system. I really think they like having that kind of power and leverage, and even having this engineering talent around wouldn't be wasted if they continue to use the Google Maps. So I think either way, it's a win-win for Apple, and that's probably why they're building up their in-house talent. And using the same investigative technique of looking through or culling through Apple's job listings, 9to5 Mac found another four job postings, this time in the area of speech recognition. Apple is looking for an iOS speech application engineer, two speech recognition engineers, and a senior speech research scientist. So Apple may be looking in the next version of iOS to expand its voice control. This is another area where we've seen Apple make other acquisitions. If you remember, Apple acquired the speech application company Siri, who has a really cool app that allows you to use natural speech to do different kinds of searches, make restaurant reservations, you can get back directions and stuff like that, all by just talking naturally into the program. And this is an area that a lot of Apple's competitors have technology that is or seems more advanced than Apple's just basic voice controls that they have in the iOS. It even took Apple a little while to get speech recognition in iOS. And I don't know that many people that actually use it. I've tried a couple times and it's really not that great. So hopefully they're focusing a little more attention on this. I think voice search and sort of voice control is something that is going to make a difference in the future. Even Steve Wozniak, I think, has come out and said that he really prefers using speech to control his devices in a couple recent interviews. So Apple definitely investing in some engineering talent for the next version of iOS. And I guess the rumor of the month is that Apple is partnering with different companies to build LCD manufacturing plants. You remember from the last MacCast, we talked about the rumor that Apple had given a bunch of money to Mitsubishi to build a new LCD facility. This time, Japan's Nikkei Daily is reporting that Sharp is repurposing an LCD TV facility to start making small to mid-sized panels, supposedly for tablets. It's estimated to go online in 2012 with a remodeling cost estimated at about $1.2 billion. The newspaper says that Apple may be footing a large portion of that bill. I think these rumors aren't really necessarily credible, just my own gut instinct, but I don't think that Apple really is directly investing in getting LCD facilities built. I think that they might have negotiations or they might be working with different companies to have long-term contracts in place or guaranteed contracts in place for ordering certain LCDs or quantities of LCDs should the companies build these facilities. And I think that might be what's going on. But as far as Apple like plunking down the money and paying to have new factories built, it just doesn't seem like something that typically they would probably do. Apple released a new update for iPhoto, and it addresses what I think is probably one of the most common complaints I've received since Apple released the new version. iPhoto 9.1.1 is out, and specifically it addresses the issue of emailing photos using an external application. One of the big new features of iPhoto 9 was that you could email directly from inside the application. The only problem was is that you had to use Apple's built-in templates to do that, and it didn't give you as much control over how those photos were embedded or attached as Apple's Mail.app did. Well, they've now added the ability to use Mail.app instead of iPhoto's built-in way for sending photos. So if you go to the preferences in the general tab, you now have an option for email photos using, and you can select iPhoto or any other mail client, including Apple Mail, Entourage, Outlook, Eudora, America Online, whatever mail client you happen to be using or prefer. Along with that, they added a couple of new templates to the built-in photo application that bring back a lot of the functionality that you get if you sent it directly to mail. A template called Classic, in my opinion, pretty much mimics exactly what you would have in mail, down to even allowing you to pick the three different optimized sizes, small, medium, or large, and or I guess four really, because you also have full size as an option, and include those as attachments to the email as well as being embedded. And then the other template is called Journal, which is just a little bit of a different layout, but also offers up the same kind of functionality as the Classic template. And by default, both those templates automatically attach the photos as well as embed them inline, whereas the other templates, all of the photos are just embedded, and then you have the option to also attach them. Also included in the iPhoto 9.1.1 update, it improves reliability when upgrading the library from an earlier version of iPhoto. iPhoto now correctly preserves the sort order of events after upgrading your library, and event titles displayed in headers can now be edited in the Photos view. It also addressed a problem that could cause duplicate photos to be added to a Mobile Me album. Scrolling overlay is now correctly displaying ratings when photos are sorted by rating, and photos are now sorted correctly when the rating is changed and photos are sorted by rating. And then finally, fixes a problem that could cause text formatting controls to become inaccessible when editing calendars. So that update is available through Apple's software update utility or on their website at apple.com/support. If you have an iPad in your house, there is, I guess, a significant chance that you might actually have two, at least according to a U.gov survey of 1,667 tablet-owning households. They showed that in 16% of the cases, those households owned more than one tablet. The survey actually does lump together ebooks along with tablets, so you're going to have to take the findings with a grain of salt. But as far as the explanations as to why a household might have two tablet devices, I actually think they're right on par. They said in 36% of the cases, it was because the person in the household with the tablet said their partner was using their device all the time and they needed to get a second one. 21% of the time, they said it was the second one was given as a gift. And 17% of the time, they said that they were just trying another type of tablet device. So I guess in those 17% of the cases, the device is definitely not a second iPad. It would be an iPad and a Kindle or something like that, iPad and a Nook reader. 13% of the time, it was because another family member, not just a partner or spouse, wanted to use the tablet all the time and they needed to pick up a second device. I have to say, around my house, it was pretty slim when we just had the iPad Wi-Fi when the iPad originally came out. It was hard for me to get time on my own iPad. So certainly getting a second device in my home helped things along. And I have a feeling that in the long term, tablets are going to end up a lot like iPads. We're suddenly going to have not just more than one or two, but three, four, five as new ones become available. I know it's like a sickness, right? Well, It's a sickness that I like to have because I love my iPad, and I think a lot of us do. Another Apple product that I bought a second one of is an Apple TV. I purchased an Apple TV too, and it looks like I was not alone. Apple reported that they expect to sell their 1 millionth Apple TV too this month. That's a significant number. I think probably a lot larger than the number of original Apple TVs Apple sold over the entire run, but I'd have to double check those numbers. Kaufman Brothers analyst Sha Wu says that that does meet high-end estimates for Apple TV 2 sales, but overall represents a pretty small portion of Apple's total annual revenue. Even with selling 1 million units, he estimates that'll be about $400 million in estimated revenue compared to $88 billion in total revenue for the company for the year. I don't know. I think that selling a million Apple TVs in just a couple of months is a significant milestone for Apple, especially considering that the Apple TV was something until recently they just considered to be a hobby. Apple released an update to its remote app for iOS. Remote app version 2.1 came out today. And you know what? Normally I wouldn't be that jazzed about the remote app being updated, but this added some really cool new features specifically related to AirPlay. And I've been, as I've mentioned on the show before, I've been excited about AirPlay, but not really felt that it's seen its full potential yet. And this is the first indication that Apple is really doing some interesting stuff with the technology. With the new remote app, you can actually initiate AirPlay video and send it to your Apple TV. So you can send it from any iTunes on your network to any Apple TV in your house. I was actually able to stream two different videos to each of my Apple TVs. I have an original first generation Apple TV and a second generation Apple TV 2. And when the update came out, I was sitting in my office. I was listening to music coming off of iTunes on my MacBook Pro. Okay, so check this out. I was streaming music from iTunes on my MacBook Pro, sending it to an Airport Express base station. That was still running. I got the new remote app. I went to my bedroom where my Apple TV 2 is, and from the same MacBook Pro, I started up a video. I started playing, I think, Star Trek or some other movie, streaming that to my Apple TV 2 from iTunes on my MacBook Pro, which was already streaming audio to my Airport Express base station. Then I went into my living room where my Apple TV 1 is and started a different video. Started streaming that from the same iTunes account, from the same MacBook Pro, and that was playing on the Apple TV in the living room. So from the one iTunes library, I was having two different video streams going to two different Apple TVs at the same time that audio was going to an Airport Express base station. And all of that could be controlled from the remote app. I could bounce between the different devices. I could see what was currently playing on that device. I could control, pause, play. All of that stuff all at the same time. So I don't know. I was impressed by that. Maybe it's not that big a deal, but having that many audio streams going on my network, and that was the Apple TV one is running 802.11g, not even N. I don't know. Seemed to work great, flawlessly, and I was duly impressed. They also added some additional features to the remote app. You can now get access to internet radio and play that. So all of those stations are now available and accessible through the remote application. You have the ability to control iTunes on your computer to play movies and TV shows that are rented from the iTunes store. I guess I didn't realize that functionality wasn't there before. It addressed also an issue with connecting to an iTunes library or an Apple TV and improved overall stability and performance. And I have to say, the remote app just keeps getting cooler and cooler and better and better. And the controls also seemed a little bit more responsive, but that just might have been my own perception. I was just maybe I was just on a high being blown away by doing all those video streams. And to be clear, I don't necessarily know that I couldn't have done that by manually initiating those streams from each Apple TV. I had honestly never tried it. What made me do it was actually the fact that I could start all of those streams and control all of those streams from the remote app. Very often for the show, I've been asked via email or through voicemails, what have you, how do I get started in learning programming either for iOS devices or for the Mac? And there's a lot of great books and resources out there. Some of the stuff from O'Reilly is really great. And of course, the Aaron Hillegass book on OS X programming is like the book, if you ask my opinion. Also, his classes and stuff that he teaches with through Big Nerd Ranch. If you haven't checked that out, bignerdranch.com is a place to go. But Apple also has some great materials and information on their website. And if you have an iOS device, they now made available 6 titles as iBooks for free. iOS Human Interface Guidelines, Object-Oriented Programming with Objective-C, Cocoa Fundamentals Guide, the Objective-C Programming Language, iOS Technology Overview, and iOS Application Programming Guide are all available now on the iBookstore. You can download them completely for free. Just go on there and search for Apple Developer Publications. So I thought that was pretty cool. They have diagrams and illustrations and stuff like that in there, and you can have them all right there on your iPad, iPhone, or iPod Touch. So if you're interested in development at all, you might want to go take a look at those since they're free. Did I mention they're free? Oh, good. Something that's not going to be free, but is still going to be cool nonetheless, is the next version of iWork 11. And when will we see it? Well, according to 9to5Mac, they're saying possibly on January 6th. They're citing some retail checks that say Apple is running low on the current version of iWork in their retail stores, iWork 09, and that no new orders are on the way to replace them. If you've been paying attention, you probably also noted that January 6th is the day that Apple will launch the Mac App Store, so it makes sense considering that the iWork apps were also in the demos and screenshots that were thrown out when Apple announced the Mac App Store, and in there, it looked like the different components within iWork were going to be offered as separate pieces, much in the same way as they are on iOS. And it's looking like the pricing is going to be about $15 to $20 per application. So you'll be able to potentially pick up Pages on its own for $15 if maybe that's the only application you really need within the suite. I'm hoping that they're also going to have some sort of bundled price that is even a little bit cheaper. So it sounds like the pricing's coming down and we might get a new version of iWork on January 6th if all these rumors turn out to be true. Also on January 6th, Apple has notified developers that they will be shutting down the OS X application webpage on apple.com. You may or may not know what that is. If you've ever been to apple.com/downloads/macOS10, that's the current location where you can find all kinds of different applications for your Mac. That's going to be superseded or replaced supposedly by the new Mac App Store. I probably should also mention another way to access that web page, at least until they remove it, is by going to the Apple menu and then clicking on the Mac OS X software link, which is the third item down. You may or may not have even noticed that was there before. I think a lot of people didn't, which is why Apple is moving everything over to the Mac App Store. One of the concerns I have about that, though, is that web page is also a great place to go for things like Automator Actions, drivers, iCal calendars, Spotlight plugins, dashboard widgets, all kinds of other stuff that I think won't be part of the Mac App Store. So I'm wondering what will happen to those if Apple's going to keep up a version of the page that includes those type of programs. There's also all those applications that maybe won't be on the Mac App Store at all. Things like I don't expect Adobe Suite or Microsoft Office or some of those other types of applications to show up right away on the App Store, specifically because some of the limitations or restrictions that Apple has imposed in terms of selling, also the rev share thing that some app developers might not want to participate in. So as far as iWork 11 coming out on January 6th, I think that the evidence right now is slim at best, but makes a lot of sense considering that Apple's going to want to launch the store with some sort of premium titles already in place. And from a consumer perspective for Apple, I don't know what could be more premium than a new version of iWork. So I guess we'll find out in a couple weeks. And then finally in the news, a few other updates to let you know about. Apple updated a couple things in Airport Base Station and Time Capsule firmware update. Version 7.5.2 was released. It fixes some issues with AirPlay streaming, general fixes for Wi-Fi base station stability, general fixes for USB interoperability when connecting to external storage devices, fixes some issues with NAT port map settings, and disables TKIP security with 802.11n rates per the Wi-Fi Alliance specification. Wow, that's kind of cool. No, I really don't know what that means, to be honest. Anyway, it's a firmware update for your base station or time capsule, so you might want to grab that if you have one of those devices. Apple also updated the Airport utility to version 5.5.2. It resolves an issue that caused DHCP settings tab to display incorrectly, resolves an issue that could have caused application to quit unexpectedly when automatically launched, resolved an issue that prevented the network password from being stored in the keychain when the network was on the 5 gigahertz band was named differently. That actually affected me with my Airport base station. I had that issue. So if you need to pick either of those updates up, you can get them through Apple Software Update Utility or through apple.com/support. And finally, a digital camera RAW compatibility update. Version 3.5 added RAW support for iPhoto and iPhoto 11 and Aperture 3 for some more cameras, including ones from Canon, Leica, Nikon, and Panasonic. And that is all of the Apple Mac news that's fit to podcast for this week, at least in my opinion. Before we move on, I want to thank another one of our show sponsors, Citrix, makers of GoToAssist Express. If you head to GoToAssist.com/MacCast right now, you can sign up for a free 30-day trial, and you probably want to do that before the holidays hit, because GoToAssist Express is a great way to provide support for friends, family members, even for your business. If you're a consultant, something like that, and you have clients, you don't want to have to be rushing out during the holidays to fix a computer problem. You can do it all remotely, quickly and easily, using GoToAssist Express. Once you have the software, all you have to do is launch it on your Mac, and it's cross-compatible, Mac, PC, doesn't matter, so you can help PC users as well as Mac users. You launch the software, you send a link to the person you're trying to help out. They click on that link, downloads the software that they need onto their computer, automatically installs it, and sets up a session where you can remotely control that system. You can get in there, you can see the screen, you can see all of the system settings, configurations, you can see what's installed on it, how much RAM they have, does it all securely over 128-bit SSL encrypted connection, so it's safe and secure. And when it's all done, when you've finished helping them and resolved the issue, quit the application. It removes the software from their computer so they don't have anything left behind. No mess, no muss, no fuss. Quick and easy, and you don't even have to open up firewall ports and do configurations and stuff like that. I really think this is one of the easiest solutions for doing remote access, remote control, and support. You can try it out free for 30 days simply by going to GoToAssist.com/MacCast. And I want to say a big thank you to Citrix for their continued support of the show. So let's kick things off here in the back half with a couple follow-up items from the prior MacCast. First off, I got John. I had talked about my usage and how I get great benefit out of 1Password, one of my favorite applications on the Mac. Well, John had a couple of other items to contribute.
Hi, Adam. This is John from Wisconsin. I've got some 1Password tips from you coming out of MacCast 330, I think it was. I've been a big 1Password user since I switched to Mac a few years ago and find it completely indispensable. You mentioned secret words and how you keep those in secret notes, or secure notes, rather. When you create a login in 1Password, if it required a question and answer type situation, 1Password typically will capture those and keep that in the login. If not, in the login, you can also add your own fields. That's where I put the secret words and the questions, or the answers to those questions. It's pretty easy to do that. You go into the login, edit it, and down towards the bottom, hit the plus sign to add fields, and you can put in anything you want. That way, all that information is in one record rather than in two. Another tip, I use tags quite a bit. I use multiple email addresses for all my different logins, and I'll tag each login to represent which email address was used. Sometimes those email addresses also end up as a special field, especially if it is a username, but not always. And the nice thing about that is when each year I change the email address that I use for my junk email, like blogs and forum posts and things like that, I can go into 1Password and search for that tag and find every account that has used that email and then know which ones need to be updated. I'll also use tags to keep track of the credit cards used for certain online sales accounts. So I'll use a tag that's just the last 4 digits of the credit card. So when I get a new card every couple of years with a new expiration date, I can go into 1Password, search for that those 4 digits, and I'll find all of the online accounts, like say utilities and Amazon and places like that, that I've got to go to and update the expiration date. So that's really good. For software, I've got 3 Macs. I use all of my software is in 1Password in the software area, and I use tags to represent which Mac the software, the license, is associated with. There's a lot of great things that you can do with 1Password. It could give you a dozen more, but fantastic. And it's also in one of the bundles right now. Maybe you mentioned that. I think it might be the Indie Bundle, so it'd be a great price for people that don't have it. Thanks much. Great podcast, and hope you find this helpful.
Yep, very helpful, John. I appreciate all of those tips. Thanks for sending those along. And that bundle that you're talking about is actually the Mac Update Bundle, which closes on December 23rd, so it may be too late for some of you. If you got the podcast early, you might still have time. If you go to mupromo.com, they have 11 apps, including 1Password, available for $49.99 US, so that's a really good deal, as John was mentioning. The other thing I wanted to just add to John's thing is I had forgot. Well, one, that when you do fill out a form on the web to sign up for a service, it does remember all of the different fields, which would include, as John mentioned, the password reminder questions, if that's something that you do get asked. And of course, as he pointed out, you can add your own fields into 1Password if you want to add additional information to that record. And I'm going to probably move those notes now, John, that you brought up that tip. I don't know why I didn't think about that before. But the other thing I wanted to point out, I noticed the other day too, is that when I updated all of my passwords in 1Password, it keeps track of a password history. So if you go back and change a password on an account that's already in 1Password, it keeps track of the prior passwords that you had used. So if you ever forget that, or for some reason it didn't stick or something like that, you can come back and it always retains that information. So just another great feature within 1Password, and certainly the software is worth checking out. Even if you missed out on one of the promos, it's well worth the price, and you can get more information at 1Password.com. That's the number 1Password.com. I don't think it's a secret by now that I'm intrigued by Apple's AirPlay technology and what it can potentially do. And somebody else who seems to be probably even more intrigued than I am is Erica Sadoun at the Unofficial Apple Weblog. I mentioned her on the last MacCast because she had figured out a way to run a little application on your Mac that would essentially turn it into an Apple TV 2 in the eyes of an iOS device, allowing you to stream AirPlay video to your Mac and play it on your Mac. Well, this week she continued her hacking and she put out an application called AirFlick. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. This time she's figured out a way to send video from applications other than iTunes on your Mac to your Apple TV. So you can actually queue up a video in Safari or QuickTime and then send that to your Apple TV too. What's even cooler is some other people have leveraged that and figured out a way to pipe that video through VideoLAN client, the video player application, and then send that stream using Erica's AirFlick software to the Apple TV 2. So that's allowing you to do things like put a DVD in your Mac, play that DVD, and stream that video to the Apple TV, essentially making it like your Apple TV 2 can play DVDs. Also, normally this would only work with video that's supported on the Mac through QuickTime, but they've also figured out that, again, using VideoLAN client, which can play back video in other codecs not normally supported by QuickTime, you could on the fly transcode that video through VLC, send it through the AirFlick application, and then pipe that to your Apple TV 2 over AirPlay. So a lot of bits and pieces, and this isn't easy stuff. There's some hacking involved, and you got to figure out some VLC codes, and they're a little bit cryptic, but Erica has the instructions up on her website. Also, I think at the unofficial Apple web blog, tuaw.com. Just search for Erica Sadoun and check out her articles. But really cool stuff. And I thought I'd share that with you because I think it's a lot of fun. Here's just a really quick tip if you're a Mobile Me user and your renewal is coming up. I actually have my renewal coming up in January. And a lot of people know that you can buy Mobile Me on Amazon.com and get a discounted price. But right now on Amazon, the current price for Mobile Me is $64.99 US. That's about $34 off the regular price of $99. But listener Lori sent me an email and said she went on Amazon to do her normal purchase and saw that there was actually two versions of Mobile Me. There was one that was the regular Mobile Me and then another one that was even cheaper, $55.99 right now, that was labeled old version of Mobile Me. And she wondered, would the old version work the same way as the one that wasn't tagged as old? And I wasn't 100% positive, but I didn't see any reason why there would be a difference. She went ahead and ordered the older version and used it, and it worked perfectly. So you can get Mobile Me at a significant discount, almost half price, if you just go through Amazon. All that's really included in the box, I think, is an activation code. So that activation code works either way, and it works for new Mobile Me subscriptions, but also works for renewals. So if your renewal is coming up, you can order the software. You can plug in the code, and even if you're not expired, it will just extend your subscription from your expiration date. So you can go ahead and just plug that in. If you're already expired, you can use it to re-up your subscription as well. So a little tip there that can save you some cash. I recently needed to move my iTunes library from one external drive to another external drive because it was filling up. It was getting full, and I've started to add some more video and things like that to my iTunes library. And we've talked about the process for doing that. Apple has instructions on their website if you need to follow those. But I realized after doing that that all of my backups, my backup plan with Time Machine and Crash Plan, which I'm using for my cloud-based backups, all of that was mapped to the old storage location. And that got me thinking that we talk about backup a lot, but we don't talk about another important part of backup, and that is reviewing your backups and making sure that your strategy is still on plan and still happening and everything is still working. And especially if you're making changes to your system, like moving significant portions of files from one external drive to another, you might not be set up to have those things backing up the way that they were when you initially set up your backup strategy. So in my case, I had to actually remap my crash plan directories. And unfortunately, I never really thought about this, but I'm having to re-upload my entire iTunes library just because I moved it from one external to another because crash plan doesn't know about that location. So I went back into the crash plan software. I said, I want to back up these files that are in this new location on this new drive. And now it's going to take another 15 days to move back up into the cloud. Now, in the meantime, the stuff I had backed up before, my library that I backed up before, is already up on crash plan. So it's not that big a deal to wait the time, but it is just something that I have to think about now. And it's part of my backup strategy. By the same token, Time Machine is not backing up my new hard drive, and the the iTunes library files that are on that in that new location. So I went back in today and actually reset up Time Machine, also excluding some of the files that I didn't want to back up from that new hard drive that I had connected. So I had to reestablish my whole strategy for Time Machine because I added this new hard drive into my system. So overall, anytime you make changes like this, it's probably a good time to check stuff, and also periodically, probably about every 3-6 months, something like that, you should go back and make sure that everything's running on schedule, double check your backups, making sure that, one, they're turned on. I had a situation one time where, for a specific reason, I think because I was doing a podcast or something like that and I didn't want it running, I turned off Time Machine. Well, guess what? I forgot to turn it back on. And 6 months later, I thought Time Machine was running. I went to use it, and lo and behold, I didn't have any of my backups. So that was an awful lesson learned, but something that you're going to want to make sure. Are your backups still running? Are they running on schedule? Are they running as expected? And that goes for Time Machine. That goes for any scheduled clone operations that you might be having going on. So if you're using Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner on a schedule, make sure those schedules are still running. It's also probably a good idea to occasionally run disk utility on your backup volumes, on your external volumes. Make sure that they, you know, verify them, make sure they're still good, there's not any issues, clean them up if there is. Make sure that you do some spot checks on your backup. Can you go into those backup volumes and actually open up files? Do they open up? If they're audio or video files, do they still play? Check a half dozen of them and make sure that they're still good. If you're doing bootable clones, you know what? Hold down, you know, restart, hold down the option key and make sure that you can boot from those volumes. Test it. Even if you did that when you initially set it up, it's probably a good idea to every few months just make sure everything's running as expected. And this little migration I did with iTunes got me thinking about that, and I thought I'd just share the reminder with you. One of the reasons I've been a Mac owner for so long is because of what I call system longevity. And what I mean by that is that typically you hear one of the arguments against Macs is the fact that they're expensive. And one of the ways I've always counteracted that argument was to say, well, you know, my Macs last a really long time. So while you might be able to get a cheap PC, you might find that you're replacing that $200, $300 PC every few years just to keep up with the times, and just because the quality of those cheaper end PCs tends to not be as good. They break down, they don't last as long. So I'll have Macs for 5, 6, 7 years. I've known people that have had Macs for like 10 years before having to replace them. And so that factors into that price point, and it works out to be, I think, at least comparable, if not more favorable on the Mac side. But I received this voicemail from Matthew, and it got me thinking about this cost savings. And another side of it, where an argument might be made that there's actually a cost savings, even if you're buying a more expensive system like a Mac, there's actually a cost savings with the rate of how quickly technology evolves now, and potentially replacing your system a little more often than maybe we did in the past. So here's what Matthew had to say.
Hello, Adam. This is Matthew, one of your visually impaired MacCast members from here in Colton, Oregon. And I just wanted to call and leave you a quick message and share with you my experience with getting a new Mac. It's been a long time since I had to purchase one. My old iMac G5 from late 2004 finally bit the dust. It had a board problem or some such and wasn't worth fixing, so I got one of the new 27-inch iMac i7 quad-core. I opted to get the fastest one they had that I could afford, which was the fastest one, and I figured I could upgrade RAM later. I said, but I got the 4 gigs and would not believe, well, you probably would believe, the difference that it makes with that hyper-threaded quad-core or 8 virtual cores. The biggest example that I'll leave you with is before on my iMac G5 running at 2 gigahertz, right, using Handbrake to transcode a one-hour video from high definition to something that I could play on my iPhone or iPod would take approximately anywhere from four to six hours, depending on the settings. And I figured, you know, it would go down to an hour or something, or 45 minutes. Mm-mm. It lit up all the processors on activity monitor. It took 7.5 minutes. That's with no add-ons or accelerator or anything like that added into the system. That's just with the quad-core i7. I was just blown away. I mean, it's just unbelievably fast. And it's nice moving to the Intel, too, but I think that that is the biggest thing that I've noticed is lighting up all those cores with something that supports that. It's just unbelievably speedy. It's a quad-core with each core running at, 2.93, I believe. So, as always, love your podcast, especially the members one on the new accessibility features. As always, very cool, Adam. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Matt. That is very cool. I mean, going from that kind of speed improvement or going to that kind of performance improvement is really significant. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of weighing the balance between longevity of your Mac and getting a cost savings that way versus maybe a potential cost savings of upgrading a little bit earlier, but gaining such a productivity and performance increase that, you know, time is money. You're going to be saving so much time. That's like getting money back, getting time back, especially for me. And I think a lot of us is, if we can do more, if we can get more done, we can make more money. And therefore, it ends up being almost a better savings than holding on to that Mac that we've had for a really long time, even though we love it. That's the other, there's an emotional investment, right, in a Mac. It was the hardest thing for me to give up my iBook G4 because that was just a rock solid machine that I absolutely loved. Unfortunately, the logic board died and I was forced to replace it, but I probably would have hung on to that thing forever. But that might not have been the best thing to do when it came down to things like, for example, encoding the podcast in GarageBand to MP3 and AAC. That takes a long time, but when I upgraded to my MacBook Pro, it took like a quarter of the time. It was like an astronomical improvement, and I have a feeling it's very similar to the kind of improvement you're experiencing with the upgrade of your iMac. So I just thought that your message was a perfect example of, you know, weighing the balance between longevity of a system versus the increase in performance. And technology is advancing so quickly. I have a feeling not just the quad cores and the multiple cores, but better RAM and faster RAM and better hard drives and just better underlying architecture and the graphics processor, you know, the operating system taking advantage of the GPU to do a lot of that encoding work. All of that's factoring into the performance increases that you're seeing. So very cool stuff. Now, also recognizing, though, sometimes we just need to hold on to our machines and maybe the increase in performance isn't going to be that much of a factor, but we might be able to actually eke out some more performance out of our old systems, too. So a tip, if you want to increase productivity of your old system, or a couple tips, I guess. One, you know, do your house cleaning. Clean off the hard drive, free up some of the space for doing memory swapping, stuff like that. Also, a fresh install every year or so, something like that, can really help out. Just cleaning out the kerfuffle, running repair permissions, all that kind of rubber chicken stuff that we normally talk about. And also, there's always the option of doing upgrades, you know, getting a bigger hard drive if you're running out of storage space, adding more RAM. I think that's probably one of the best upgrades you can do. So if you haven't maxed out the RAM in your old system, go online. RAM prices are, you know, always dropping, so you can get a pretty affordable upgrade. Throw in some more RAM, max it out. That will really increase things. Getting a faster hard drive can sometimes help, depending on the types of applications that you're using and running. If you're doing a lot of disk swapping or read-write access, switching from a 5400 RPM to a 7200 RPM drive, or even bumping up to an SSD, might give you enough performance to eke another couple years of life out of that old system and increase your productivity at the same time. So you might get a little double whammy for your efforts. Thanks again, Matt, for the comments. I really appreciate it. Also, really appreciate you being a MacCast member. I appreciate the support and glad to hear you're enjoying the extra content each week. If you'd like to get some extra MacCast content and also support the show at the same time for just a couple bucks a month, you can do that by becoming a MacCast member. You can get more information and details on that program at member.maccast.com. So I've been having some weird networking issues on my Wi-Fi network at home, and these happened kind of recently. I added an Airport Express base station to my wireless network. I needed to do some range extending, and I had had an Airport Express base station, 802.11g1, that I'd been using for a while, but I had to keep moving it back and forth because I was also using it to do some printer sharing in my office, and I needed another range extender that was over in the hallway to extend the range of my network to my bedroom. So I bought that, and ever since I added it to my network, I started having issues specifically with my iOS devices, my iPhone 4 and my iPad, where it was just, it wouldn't be that I lost connectivity, but the connectivity seemed glitchy or the performance seemed a little bit less. And then this week I saw an article, one of the problems I had been having with my Apple TV 2, which also sits on that same part of my network, was that when I would get purchased or rental content, the buffering would take forever or just completely stop midstream. So I would start playing something. It could be from Netflix. It could be from anything. And it would be going along fine. And then suddenly it would just stop or stutter or have to rebuffer or just never buffer. And I have to reset. It was just kind of a big pain. And there were some other people experiencing similar issues. Well, this thing came out this week that part of the problem might be using third-party DNS servers, domain name servers. And that's something that you typically hear people say, oh, you should use a third-party DNS instead of the one that your ISP provides because you'll get better performance. So I have been using for the longest time OpenDNS. And a lot of people also use Google's DNS. And this person, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he figured out that there's a problem with using a third-party DNS domain name server when accessing content that might be on a CDN, a content delivery network. And for those of you who don't know what that means, what a CDN means, that is services like Akamai, like Cashfly, like some of these services, and iTunes uses Akamai. What they do is when a video is put out by Apple on their servers, it's not just put out on their servers, it's put out on the content delivery network or distribution network. I can't remember what the D stands for. And what happens is that file goes out there and then it gets copied to different servers that are geographically located. And the idea is that to increase performance for delivery of that type of content, that really high bandwidth content like video and audio and stuff like that, especially streaming, what you want to do is you want to move those files closer to the actual computers that are accessing them. So the ideal situation is that video file is sitting on a server at your internet service provider, at your ISP, or at least close to it geographically, and that way you don't have to go through a bunch of servers to get that content. So that's the idea behind the CDN. The problem is when you're using a third-party DNS server, I guess a lot of these content delivery networks use domain name service routing, DNS routing, to determine geographically your location rather than, I guess, your IP address or the IP address that would be in the router from your server. I don't really understand how that works, but the essence is that it's using the DNS information to figure out your location and therefore serve up the file. So this particularly becomes a problem if you're using, say, Google's DNS servers, which are in the United States, and you're in another country. What happens is when you go to request a video from a service like iTunes, it says, oh, you're in the US, and it's delivering that file from the US rather than delivering it from, say, a server, a content delivery server in your own country, which it normally would do if you were using your ISP's DNS. another related problem would just be saturation. If everybody is using, say, Google's DNS server, and the DNS server is looking at Google and seeing all those people as coming from the same location, it's going to be serving all of that content off of the same CDN server, thus kind of saturating and slowing down that server. So those are the theories behind the problem anyway. And supposedly switching back to your ISP's server might help the situation. Now, OpenDNS said that they don't suffer the same problem as Google because they've worked with the CDN services and they have their stuff set up differently. I don't know if that's the case or not. Just in case, I went ahead and switched my server back to my local ISP for the DNS service. So I'll have to see over the next week or so if that improves performance a bit. But another thing I did at the same time, and I probably should have done each one of these at once, but another thing that I did was based on some other reported problems with iOS devices ever since I think iOS 4 came out. And there have been this back and forth between Apple saying it's fixed the issue and people reporting that they're still having the issue. Issues with DHCP and DHCP lease times. And if you don't know what DHCP is, in a nutshell, probably a longer conversation that we need to have, but in a nutshell, that's the service that's running on your router, say your airport base station, that assigns addresses to the devices on your network. And it does that dynamically. And each one of those addresses is given to the device for a set period of time as determined by the router. And what's supposed to happen is after that set period of time expires, the device is supposed to go back to the base station and say, you know what, I'm still using this address. I need to keep it for longer, and it should reissue that address, or it should expire if the device is no longer using it, give that back to the server, and then that the server has that address available to give out to other devices that might come on to the network. So as you have more devices on your network, these addresses are expiring and being given back and being reassigned out. And there's been some issues with that whole process with the iOS devices, specifically, I think, related to sleep and wake issues. Because of the power management on iOS devices, they're going to sleep and come, you know, going off the network and coming on the network, going back and forth. And what happens typically, I think, is that the lease expires, the router thinks that it has that address available, gives it to another device, and then the iPad or iPhone or iPod Touch that had that address wakes back up. It still has that address assigned to it, and then you have a conflict, and then that can knock a device off the network, and then it might renegotiate and reconnect. And this was my theory, that this was the problem I was having, because my iOS devices were going on and off my network and causing conflicts, and that was causing these sort of hiccups that I was having, where I'd be streaming something and suddenly it would just pause or buffer or be really slow. So it was my theory is network collisions. I'm not an expert in this stuff, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but I figured it was worth a shot to see, well, what would happen if I switched from dynamic IP addresses to static IP addresses? So I took each one of my iOS devices that I was having this issue with and actually gave it its own IP address. So it wasn't getting it from the server. It was already pre-assigned, never has to re-ask for it, it never expires, and see if that fixed my performance. And lo and behold, so far, that seems to be working. So my theory seems to be holding up. Whether or not it's just perception, I don't really know yet. I'll have to let you know. But one of the fixes also, if you're suffering from the DHCP lease issues, that is also recommended, is just to up the amount of time that a device is allowed to have that lease. So I checked my airport base station, and it was set to each IP address being assigned for 4 hours. You can actually launch Airport Utility, and you can go into the manual setup, click on the manual setup button, and then go under the internet section to the DHCP tab, and then just check the DHCP lease time, and you can change the time between minutes, hours, and days. So you can set it up if your devices aren't changing all that often on your network. Maybe you want to just assign it to be several days to hold on to that IP address for each device before it has to request or re-request the lease. Princeton was actually reporting on a new DHCP issue where they were saying that iOS basically allows the DHCP lease to expire, but then continues to use the IP address after the device continues to use the IP address after the lease has expired. So that, again, as I was mentioning before, the server, the router thinks it has the address available to reuse, yet the iOS device is kind of holding on to it. And typically this wouldn't be an issue in a home network because you don't have that many devices, but as we get more devices, I think this is becoming a problem. And in my case, I looked at my home network. It's unbelievable how many devices. So I have 3 Macs, a Mac Mini, an iMac, a MacBook Pro. I have 4 iPhones, 2 new ones, and my 2 old ones, which are kind of used like iPod touches, but they're on the Wi-Fi network, so they have IP addresses assigned to them. 2 iPads, 2 Apple TVs, 3 AirPorts, a TiVo, and a Wii. They're all getting addresses from the DHCP server. So it's entirely possible that I could be having conflicts. And as we get other devices, you know, I know other people who have houses and their kids have PSPs or Nintendo DSs. A lot of Blu-ray players are now having IP addresses. Your cable and your set-top boxes, video recorders. I mean, it's unbelievable how many things are using Wi-Fi on home networks and need IP addresses assigned to them. So I think this is only to become a problem, more and more of a problem, and Apple either needs to fix the DHCP issues in their software, or in the meantime, it sounds like a potential solution would be to assign static IP addresses to your devices and go that way, especially if you don't always need dynamic addresses. So I'm going to try that method for a while, and I'll let you know how it goes. And then lastly today, I'm going to try and answer a question that I get all the time, and I always dread this question because I always feel like I don't have the good answer or the right answer. And in my defense, I don't think it's my fault. I think this is a big Apple issue, and it's something that Apple needs to resolve. But Fred emailed me. He's going on vacation. I'm assuming probably Christmas or holiday break. And he normally has his MacBook Pro hooked up to an external drive, and that's where his library is. And that's something that I do as well. So I feel your pain, Fred. I've suffered exactly this same dilemma. And he doesn't want to take his full library with him. He's not going to take that external drive when he goes on vacation, but he's going to take the MacBook Pro. That drive, though, has all of his content on it. It has his music, his media files, his movies, his applications, and in his case, he's specifically concerned about the apps. He wants to know, I want to take this, I'm going to take my iPhone, my iPod Touch with me, and I still want to be able to sync my applications. I also want to be able to download new applications or buy new applications and know that I can sync those to my device. So he wanted to know, how do I get those applications moved over, just the applications moved over to the MacBook Pro, but not have to bring everything along with me? Can I do that? And can I continue to sync my MacBook Pro with my device? And can I get everything to sync back to that external drive when I return? And my answer is maybe, kinda. I think you can. I've played around with this. You actually can, but it doesn't work as I would expect it to work, or as I would think Apple would make it work. So the key to this, at least as far as I understand it, is to make sure that you've set up the MacBook Pro with the external drive to always keep the iTunes media folder organized, and that you have the option set to copy all of your iTunes media to a folder when adding it to the library. Those two options, and I think those are required, because what you need to do is you need to know that everything is kind of in a known location and organized in a way that iTunes expects it to be organized. If you have that set up, then what I think you can do is copy any files that you want from the iTunes media folder on the external drive to the iTunes media folder on the internal drive of the MacBook Pro, and that's to the default location, which would be in your home folder, in the music folder, in iTunes, in a folder called iTunes Media. And inside there, specifically if you're just looking to do your applications, you're going to want to copy all of the files that are in the mobile applications folder. So copy those from the external drive to the internal drive on the MacBook Pro into that location. And then once you've done that, you should be able to use the internal folder to sync all of your applications just fine. What will happen is when you disconnect your Mac from the external drive and you launch iTunes, iTunes is going to default back to the default location for your iTunes media folder in the home folder, inside that music folder, inside the iTunes folder. And it's going to look for your mobile applications there. And as long as they're all there, they should sync. Any files that you haven't copied over from that external drive to the internal drive in that location are going to show up in your iTunes library with the little exclamation point broken icons, and you're not going to be able to access those. So that'll include things like music and podcasts and any apps you didn't copy over. Anything you didn't copy over is going to get that little broken link. If you try and play it, it's going to say, I can't find that. Do you want me to locate it? When you actually do sync your device, when you plug it in and you sync your device, you're also going to get errors, sync errors that say, I can't copy over these files because they don't, essentially because they don't exist. The good news is they're not going to be removed from your device. So if you've already synced music content and video content and stuff over and you use this method, it's not going to actually remove them. It's going to leave them in place. You're still going to get these sync errors. And that's why I'm saying this is totally broken on Apple's part. So while you have your content over there, you can sync the local content, but your iTunes library is a mess while you're disconnected because it can't find any of the files. Yet you can continue to add new content. So if you make new purchases, you're going to be able to add that into your library. That's going to show up fine. You're going to be able to play it, but it's going to be intermixed with all these broken icons and links. So this goes for podcasts and apps and any new music purchases you make from the iTunes store. You can grab that stuff. You'll be able to sync it over your devices. Everything is going to work fine. It's just going to look really ugly. Then what happens is when you get back to your hard drive and you reconnect it, it's going to link everything back up. But you're now going to have your media files in, you're going to have your files in two locations, some that you downloaded while you were on the road in that internal location and all of your old stuff that you left behind on the external drive. When the drive is connected and you've reconnected iTunes, it is going to automatically point itself back at that external drive. And you're going to want to verify that once you're reconnected by going into iTunes, going into the preferences, clicking on advanced, and making sure that one, the location for your media folder is on that external drive, and two, that you still have that keep iTunes media folder organized option checked and the copy to iTunes media folder when adding to library option checked. Once you've done that, you're going to go under the file menu under library and click on organize library. And then check the consolidate files option and click OK. And then what will happen is everything that you downloaded when you were on the road, podcasts and any stuff that you bought and any new apps that you purchased, that's all going to get copied back over to the external drive. And you should see that in the status once you've clicked consolidate files, and it'll move it all back over to the external drive. Once it's there, it'll all be linked up and you can go back to the internal drive and clean things up. You can delete all that stuff off the internal drive and grab your space back. So it's going to work for you, but it's going to be real messy in the process. Now, some people will say that, well, you know, when you're on the road, when you're mobile, you can actually hold down the option key when you launch iTunes and you can create a new blank media library. But the problem with that is when you connect your iOS device, it's going to warn you and it's going to say, this device is synced with another computer. Do you want me to erase all of the content on the device, remove all the content, and resync with this new library? And that's absolutely what you don't want, because it's going to remove all your applications, all your media files, everything from your iOS device, and you're going to lose all that. So you either have to live with the broken links, or you have to deal with an iOS device that has no content or a subset of the content on it that you had before, including missing a lot of your applications. And I think that's not what you want. So Apple really needs to fix this problem. They need to figure out a way for us to be mobile and still have our libraries. I don't know what the absolute solution is. Maybe some of you have some tips or tricks for doing this, but I have not found a good solution for this, which is why I always dread this question. So Fred, I don't know if I helped you a lot or just confused you even more. It's confusing to me. So that's about the best I can do. And that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Thanks for hanging out. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out the software. Also check out the new iPad version of Notebook. You can get more information and details at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Check it all out. And don't forget that you can get a 30% discount on Disk Label this month by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. You can get more information and details as well as trials at phoronix.com. And Cocotec, check out Pathfinder 5. You can get free trials on their website as well as more information at cocotec.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Thanks to you for hanging out, for listening. Really appreciate it. If you'd like to further support the MacCast, you can do that by becoming a MacCast member. You can get more information and details on the program at member.maccast.com. If you have any feedback for me, a question, a comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call them in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can also leave a voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you do leave a voicemail, if you could leave your email address and spell it out for me, that is greatly appreciated, just in case I have any follow-up questions or need to get back to you before the next episode airs. If you want to find show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum, forum.maccast.com. Great place to hang out with other members of the MacCast community. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. It's almost Christmas time. During the holidays, we play holiday and Christmas tunes here on the MacCast. This one this week comes from the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. It's actually from a band. I've played this on the show, I think, every year for the last few years. It's one of my favorite Christmas tunes. Very appropriate with the title Christmas is Here because it's right upon us. It's by Number One Fan. Unfortunately, I don't think the band is together anymore, but their music is still available on iTunes. So if you'd like to buy a copy, you can get that. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But here is Christmas is Here by Number One Fan. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time. Don't